Hello, my friends. This is Dr. Beter. Today is September 29, 1978, and this is my audio letter number 38. News reports today are filled with headlines about the surprise death last night of Pope John Paul I after a lightning-fast surprise election hardly a month ago. Last month I revealed the plan of Bolshevik influences within the Vatican to maneuver the new pope into aligning 700 million Catholics against Russia. But already Pope John Paul has left the scene, and the game plan I told you about last month will now be tried again with another new pope. Surprises are now all around us as we approach Nuclear War I. On Sunday evening 12 days ago, September 17, 90 to 100 million Americans were glued to their television sets. Just as programs on all three networks were reaching a climax, they were interrupted for a stunning news special. Suddenly we saw the smiling, jubilant faces of Jimmy Carter, Egypt's President Sadat, and Israel's Prime Minister Begin. For nearly 2 weeks we have been fed a steady diet of depressing, discouraging news from the Camp David summit. Yet now, here was our President announcing a thrilling breakthrough for peace. Before our very eyes, the heads of state of Egypt, Israel, and the United States were signing the seemingly miraculous Camp David Accords. It was a masterstroke of public relations propaganda by our unseen rulers. Throughout the United States and the rest of the world, the news media were caught by surprise. Even Time and Newsweek had to stop their presses to change their cover stories. And 3 days later, Radio Australia summed up the feelings of the news media worldwide in the words, quote, "No one could have predicted the outcome of Camp David," unquote. My friends, the Dr. Beter audio letter was the only news source in the entire world that correctly forecast the outcome of the Camp David summit. Last month, before the summit even began on September the 5th, I recorded the following words, quote, "Suddenly the hard-line attitudes of recent days will seem to evaporate on both sides, much to everyone's surprise. Conciliation and mutual concessions will become the order of the day, and the joyful shouts of peace, peace will ring in our ears. The euphoria surrounding the outcome of the Camp David summit will be like an echo of the high hopes of last November 1977, just after Sadat's trip to Jerusalem," unquote. My friends, the so-called surprise outcome at Camp David was planned in advance, and the flimsy Camp David agreements are not intended by our unseen rulers to produce peace. Instead, they are to collapse in such a way as to ignite war, as I detailed for you last month. Even now, the initial euphoria over Camp David is giving way to concern over signs that the whole thing might come apart. And Saudi Arabia is being drawn into the limelight as the crucial factor, meaning stumbling block, in the proposed Middle East peace framework. In this way, Saudi Arabia is being led into the nuclear trap which I described last month. It's all part of the plan of our unseen rulers for an American nuclear first strike against Russia, which I revealed in detail last month. And so far, it is right on track. I also revealed that Jimmy Carter, while posing as a man of peace, is actually waiting for his supreme moment, a moment of crisis. He's in an artificial euphoric state, maintained by medication and other means, and is actually looking forward to pulling the trigger to launch America's nuclear first strike against Russia. But, my friends, I must now reveal a gruesome fact which Jimmy Carter himself may not know. Jimmy Carter will not get to pull the trigger. Instead, he is being set up to be the trigger for war. At the Camp David summit, Anwar Sadat literally begged Carter to put pressure on Begin to make concessions on East Jerusalem especially that would strengthen the agreements in the Arab world. Carter said in effect, quote, "I cannot at this time, but I give you my word personally that I will work on the Israelis on this, unquote. Sadat, desperate for an agreement, accepted Carter's personal pledge in a tremendous gamble. And this gamble for peace will backfire tragically, my friends, because Jimmy Carter is being medicated for reasons beyond psychological conditioning. Just within the past 3 weeks, Jimmy Carter has suddenly contracted two forms of terminal cancer. One is acute leukemia, or cancer of the blood, whose symptoms include weakness and fatigue. Lately, Carter has been displaying these symptoms, and they have been noticed by close observers. The other cancerous infection now plaguing Jimmy Carter is a tumor on the left side of his head. In due course, this tumor is expected to cause pronounced disabling effects. If the terminal illness of Jimmy Carter progresses as fast as expected, the reins of presidential power will pass from his hands within a matter of months. Whether by disability or death, Jimmy Carter's downfall will pull the rug out from under a shaky Anwar Sadat. Carter's personal pledge to Sadat will become meaningless, and without it, the Camp David agreements will disintegrate, and the Middle East war buildup I described last month will take place. Jimmy Carter's death or disability is intended also to play a pivotal role in advancing the Bolshevik Revolution in the United States, which is already well underway, quietly. Nelson Rockefeller's 25th Amendment to the United States Constitution will come into play, and Vice President Walter Mondale will become acting president should Carter become disabled. Already a trial run for this situation has been carried out during the Camp David summit. In an unprecedented action, Carter turned over the reins of the presidency to Mondale while he went to Camp David. In this way, Carter was relieved of all responsibilities, and Camp David was, for him, a vacation. But even after conserving his dwindling energies in this way, Carter emerged from Camp David more tired than when he entered. The downfall of Jimmy Carter will be accompanied by turmoil, both domestically and internationally, and cataclysmic effects in the Middle East. Demands will mount for firm, experienced leadership of a bipartisan nature during these critical days, and when Jimmy Carter either resigns or dies, a new vice president will be nominated by Mondale to fill the bill. The appointee, as now planned, will be a Rockefeller Republican, and if his declining health permits, it will be Nelson Rockefeller himself. My friends, last month it seemed that I shocked many of my listeners by urging them to make serious preparations to leave the United States to avoid the coming nuclear war. Many of my critics, when asked to comment on what I have said, are telling their followers, quote, stay and fight, unquote. But these are the same people who have been stirring the pot without any impact for years, 10 years, 20 years, and even longer. They have not prevented a single one of America's reverses from taking place. And when they say stay and fight, they don't bother to tell you how to fight neutron bombs, particle beam weapons, or anything else. Can you imagine that? And some of them are even telling you to stay and fight while they themselves are financially prepared to leave at a moment's notice. My friends, for years I've sounded the alarm together with the message that we could stop what was coming if only we would do it. And I made public the information that could have been used to bring about a reversal of our slide into catastrophe. But time does run out when action is not taken. And things do change. They do not remain static decade after decade, as some of my critics would lead you to believe. The time has come to think about your own family. It's time to prepare to live to fight another day. For the many people who have contacted me to ask where to go, I can only say that I have given you my best recommendations 2 months ago in Audio Letter 36. And during the past 2 years or more, I've spelled out the target areas worldwide that are targeted by Russian underwater missiles. I have described the Russian preparations for geophysical warfare. I have given details about the Russian patterns of nuclear sabotage of the United States. I've outlined the Russian preparations for invasion of the United States from Canada and Mexico. And I've given you both the American and Russian strategies for Nuclear War I. And from all these things, you are the one to decide how best to use your resources to take care of yourself in preparation for a nuclear war. Your life is at stake, so it's up to you to evaluate these things for yourself. I believe that the time has come to give you a thumbnail sketch of what to expect after Nuclear War I, based on Kremlin plans. Only a true miracle, my friends, could save the West now, and we are doing nothing to merit a miracle. My three topics for today are topic number 1, Russia's holy war to wipe out Bolshevism. Topic number 2, Russia's blueprint for domination of the Earth. And topic number 3, Russia's program to launch mankind into space. Topic number 1. Later this fall, television viewers in a few American cities will be able to watch a documentary series called The Unknown War. It is a major series consisting of 20 programs showing newsreel films taken during the Siege of Leningrad and World War II. Originally, The Unknown War TV series was intended to be shown nationwide over network television. When the project was proposed over 2 years ago, network officials verbally encouraged it, but now the networks have turned their backs on the Unknown War series. Only 9 stations scattered across the United States plan to carry it as of now. The television series contains scenes of unspeakable suffering by the Russians during those 900 days in Leningrad. Most viewers, haunted by the enormous tragedy unfolded before their very eyes, can't help feeling some sympathy and admiration for the Russians who endured all that. When the project began over 2 years ago, our unseen rulers wanted to build up the Soviet Union, their secret ally, in our eyes. But now everything has changed. Russia has terminated the secret Rockefeller-Soviet alliance through military double-cross in preparations for all-out war. So now the networks no longer want programs and news items that build up Russia's image. Instead, we are being shown everything possible to paint Russia as the enemy and to make us think increasingly in terms of war. My friends, the rulers of Russia are waging a holy war. They are out to save their own souls and the soul of Russia. And to do that, they believe they must wipe out what they think of as a cancerous disease, Bolshevism. It's a well-known fact that the Bolshevik Revolution in Russia in 1917 was carried out by revolutionaries with outside support and financing. And much of that financing, as I explained in the past, originated with the Rockefeller interests. Thus was born the secret Rockefeller-Soviet alliance, which lasted for nearly 60 years. But as I first mentioned last November 1977 in AUDIO LETTER 28, there was another faction in the 1917 revolution whose role has never been widely recognized in the West. This other faction consisted of the self-styled spiritual communists. Unlike the Bolsheviks, the spiritual communists are a native religious sect which began within Russia more than 2 centuries ago. Their numbers have never been large, but even in Tsarist Russia their influence politically was sometimes very great. They are tough, and they are perhaps the most tightly knit religious group on earth. They insist on taking literally many things in the Bible which in their view are swept under the rug generally in the West. The breed who rule Russia today take their beliefs very seriously indeed, not for show, but as a guide to action and in setting policies of all kinds. This is the reason for many strange differences which have been noticed in recent years between Russia and the West. For example, in the United States, homosexuality is increasingly being tolerated, encouraged, and even smiled upon legally, whereas in Russia, it is a capital offense and punishable as such. But the spiritual communists of Russia believe that they made one horrible mistake 6 decades ago. That mistake was to ally themselves with the Bolshevik communists, thereby guaranteeing the success of the Bolshevik Revolution. The communism of the spiritual communists had derived originally from biblical passages that referred basically to sharing and mutual support among believers. This evolved into a political view, which in turn became compatible with Marxism. Finally, this led to the alliance between the spiritual communists and the Bolsheviks early in this century. It was only after the Bolshevik Revolution was past the point of no return that the spiritual communist faction began to realize what a serious mistake they had made. Watching as junior partners in the revolution, they saw the Bolsheviks shed all pretenses of morality and humanity as they acquired power. All the high-sounding promises of equality and justice evaporated, to be replaced by terrorism and a satanic government. Before the revolution, millions of Russian Christians had been calmed down in their worries over Bolshevik agitation by priests who assured them of divine intervention to protect them. But when the revolution came, Russian Orthodox bishops and priests were rounded up by the thousands to be tortured, then executed, and millions of Russian Christians who had sat back and done nothing because of the soothing words of their priests began dying like flies in the Bolshevik inferno. They did not know that the Bolsheviks had infiltrated the Russian Orthodox Church before the revolution. But the spiritual communists, observing the carnage, investigated and found out what had happened. And today they see it all happening again in the West, especially in the United States. The spiritual communists, after they realized their blunder, took stock in order to decide what to do. They finally concluded that there was only one way they could hope to atone for their mistakes and save their souls. They must work untiringly to undo the Bolshevik control of Russia they had helped to bring about. And beyond that, they must work to rid the world of Bolshevism itself, so that what had happened to Russia could never happen again. And with that, they vowed a holy war against the Bolsheviks. Their holy war was to progress in three phases. Phase one was to involve continued alliance with the Bolsheviks, but with the spiritual communists increasing their own power at every turn at the expense of the Bolsheviks. Their operating principle during this phase was to be reduction of severity of purges and repression wherever possible, but never at the risk of jeopardizing the overall takeover program. Phase two, to begin as soon as the spiritual communists became more powerful than the Bolsheviks, was to be the actual weeding out of all Bolsheviks in Russia. And finally, phase three was to involve actual warfare by a non-Bolshevik Russia against Bolshevism worldwide. Phase one of the spiritual communist holy war against Bolshevism lasted for 35 years. The turning point to phase two came on March 5, 1953. With the death of Joseph Stalin. From that point onward, the spiritual communists have held the upper hand over their Bolshevik partners, although even the Bolsheviks themselves were kept unaware of what was taking place until very recently. The de-Stalinization campaign of Nikita Khrushchev, which stunned the world over 20 years ago, was the first visible sign of this shift. Now phase two is nearing completion. I can reveal that there is not one Bolshevik in the inner circle of the Kremlin. The same holds true for the top military hierarchy of Russia. And even the military personnel who man all three legs of the Russian space triad, the moon base, the Cosmos Interceptor Killer satellites, and the hovering cosmospheres, share the same distinction. They have all been scientifically screened to ensure their complete loyalty to Russia. Meanwhile, Bolsheviks are being expelled from Russia in ever-increasing numbers, and they are being absorbed mainly into the United States. In mid-September, in fact, United States immigration laws were quietly amended to allow them to come in here faster. And once here, they are being planted rapidly in all levels of the United States government, even though they cannot speak good English. Security clearances for them are practically nil. And so the stage is being set for the third and final phase of the Russian holy war against Bolshevism. This final phase, which is imminent, is Russia's all-out war against all pockets of Bolshevism worldwide. Down through history, it has always been true that holy wars are the most uncompromising and bloodiest of all. Many centuries ago, the Muslim jihads brought stark terror upon their victims. Likewise, the Christian Crusades brought mayhem and destruction on a scale that was unparalleled in those times. But the holy war by Russia against the Bolsheviks is unlike any other holy war in the past several thousand years. The Muslims and their jihads sought to convert the infidels at the point of a sword. Likewise, the Christians and their crusades sought to liberate the Holy Land and convert the heathen at the point of a sword. The Russian holy war against the Bolsheviks is different, far different. After 60 years of the most intensive, grueling experience, the spiritual communists have concluded that all true Bolsheviks are impossible to convert to a faith in God. Bolshevism, therefore, is evil incarnate. So they have concluded that the only way to eliminate Bolshevism as a force in the world is to eliminate the Bolsheviks themselves throughout the world, and that is what their holy war is intended to do. Today, the center of Bolshevism is the United States of America. The rulers of Russia look at the United States as they would a rabid dog. The dog is dying of rabies and is also a danger to everyone else. So the only thing that can be done is to destroy the dog. Bolsheviks are now infiltrated throughout the United States, in all levels of government, in education, in entertainment, in the news media, and even in all branches of the church. And the Rockefeller Bolshevik plan for a nuclear first strike against Russia constitutes a clear and present nuclear threat. So the Kremlin is wasting no time in completing preparations to smash the United States militarily. The only hope of preventing Russia's devastation of America, my friends, would be our own swift action to rout out the Bolsheviks in our midst. If we did that, Russia would no longer have any need to attack. In the West, Bolshevism has been unleashed full force by the Rockefellers. It is fast becoming a force unto itself, and already Western Bolshevism is breaking loose from Rockefeller control. Increasingly, it's not the Rockefeller brothers who are using the Bolsheviks, but the other way around. Soon the remaining three Rockefeller brothers will fade from the scene, but that will not undo the cancer of Bolshevism with which they have infected the West. In Russia, it took the spiritual communists 60 years to overcome the Bolsheviks. Only now is their final rout of the Bolsheviks taking place. My friends, we do not have 60 years. The time left to us is measured in months before Russia's holy war against Bolshevism enters its final phase, Nuclear War I, with the United States of America as the prime battleground. Topic number 2. 2 months ago, in July 1978, the wife of Philippine President Marcos visited Moscow. In doing so, she joined a fast-growing stream of state visitors who are stepping on the Kremlin's doorstep these days from all over the world. The reasons for Moscow's popularity these days were reflected in remarks by Mrs. Marcos, as reported by Newsweek in its July 24 issue. According to Mrs. Marcos, Prime Minister Kosygin told her that Russia and her allies will control the high seas, space, and most of the world's landmass by the early 1980s. And as Mrs. Marcos put it, quote, "No one wants to be caught on the losing side," unquote. My friends, Kosygin's remarks were not a mere boast. They were a sober declaration of what the Kremlin both intends and expects to achieve. During the past 2 years and more, I have made public enough information about Russia's military power and weaponry to make one thing painfully obvious. If Russia's only concern were to win a war with the United States and our allies, Nuclear War I would have erupted as long ago as the summer of 1976. At that time, as I revealed publicly in AUDIO LETTERS 14 through 16, the Soviet Navy began planting short-range underwater-launched nuclear missiles within our own territorial waters. For a while, action was taken to stave off this Russian capability for a zero-warning preemptive strike under the brave leadership of General George S. Brown, then Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. And on September 16, 1976, I met with General Brown in his Pentagon office for over an hour without interruption to relay crucial information to him that was being blocked from reaching him through normal channels. But then came the heart-rending Red Friday Agreement of October 1, 1976, which I reported that month in AUDIO LETTER 17. On that day, then-President Gerald Ford succumbed to personal blackmail and tied General Brown's hands in a spineless agreement to appease Russia. Barely 2 weeks later, General Brown was attacked viciously in the press and made to apologize over nationwide television for his alleged misconduct. Meanwhile, Russia was proceeding without interference in ringing America with underwater missiles. From Red Friday 1976 onward, Russia has been increasingly in a position to rain military disaster on the West at will. This ability became complete 1 year ago with the Battle of the Harvest Moon and its immediate aftermath. And yet, Russia still has not attacked for two reasons. One reason is military, but the larger reason is that Russia is looking beyond nuclear war one to the conditions under which Russia will dominate a conquered Earth.
This is the end of Side 1.